This is DV Radio.
You could listen to one of those other stations, but what would your friends think?
He's worked alongside Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore as the co-author of Hal Moore on Leadership, Winning, Win Out, Gunned and Out Man. Not only that, he was the Military Writers Society of America Author of the Year for 2021. Has so many nominations, I didn't even write them down over the years. Honestly, his writings have probably told more stories in history than I ever got from a history book. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Mike Guardia.
DV Radio.
Before we jump into your latest book, The Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Front Lines of World War II, how the hell have you been, brother? It's been a minute.
I got to tell you, brother, I've been great. I am living what I can only say is my best life. And I am waking up every morning on this side of the dirt. I am doing what I love, surrounded by the people I love. And I got a lot of good memories from my time in service and, able to share my passions with wonderful people like you.
I appreciate it. It's always good to have you on. I know, we say it every time you're on here, but it's an honor to have you on. It really is. I mean, to know you,
honor to be here.
To know you and to be able to share time with you, man, it's beautiful. I mean, the first time we had you on was Hal Moore on Leadership, which was what, 18, 19, somewhere in there.
Yeah, gosh, brother, it had to have been, I think it was the summer of 2018.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been that long. We were talking, I was talking to somebody the other day about Objective Zero, and we've been with them since before they were an app. And I was like, oh my God, it's been multiple years. Like, you can't say 2 years. It's like years, you know. It's like, oh my God, time is long. Since we first had you on, Hal Moore on Leadership to now, how much has changed for you as far as being a writer and things of that nature?
Well, I think I've expanded my wheelhouse, and I also think that I've been able to feel a deeper connection with a lot of the subject matters that I've taken on. You know, I think that now, really as a function of where we are in the geopolitical landscape, mm-hmm. you know, now that the war in Afghanistan has wound down and we have a lot of returning veterans who are getting out of the service and who are reintegrating into society, I think that veteran stories take on a more meaningful flavor with the public in general. And, being that it's a rough time for a lot of everybody or for a lot of other people on the international stage, that these veteran stories are really going to resonate across borders. So I think for me, the biggest thing has just been trying to find these veteran stories and get them out to the general public. And really, for me, what's changed the most is just being able to make those meaningful connections and keep those connections going forward. And, you know, just trying to keep those good ties with the veterans community in a way that keeps their stories out in the public.
Right. Definitely. You and I are roughly the same age. I'm not going to put our ages out there because nobody actually needs to know that. But we grew up in roughly the same generation as far as, like you said, political and wars and stuff of that nature. From then to when you started doing these books to now, how has writing the stories changed? I know everything's a passion, right? But our passions change dramatically when we start getting involved in things. And I know things have hit you way differently than it would somebody who's writing a biography for somebody that's already dead and they never got to live with them or talk to them. I mean, you've got to speak to Hal Moore and all of these soldiers over the years and talk to their families. So from then to now, has it been a big change perception wise and motivation wise, or is it about the same? Or
I really think it has. You know, I think that really the biggest change has just been seeing how multiple people can perceive the same event. You know, because when you and I were growing up in the 90s, you know, a lot of the history that was presented to us, you know, was really a bird's eye view of all of these different historical events that happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, throughout, I think, the formal educational experience that we have as American students, it's typically presented to us in those broad sweeping terms. And you don't really get the full view of what these historical events look like at the end user level. So when I started writing books, that was really the biggest change for me. It took these events that I only knew in a macro sense, these events that I had only read about and that I had seen about through documentary footage from the bird's eye view, and really get into the personal perspectives of the people who were there to experience it in real time, and how all of those events have affected them many years and even decades down the line. And what I think I've learned in an even broader sense, and what I want to come across in each of the stories that I write, is that war is never a clinical pursuit. There's always a very intimate human dimension to it. You know, we can all agree on the facts of what happened, like this conflict started on this particular date, ended on this particular date, and it involved these units doing these maneuvers to seize this objective. But, you know, you really get a richer part of the story when you see how all the different key players perceived it and how they took those experiences forward with them into their everyday lives. Because, you know, you have all these events that have affected people in a positive way, and then you have these events that have affected people in an incredibly negative way. You know, many of our comrades, even, who were just not able to effectively wrestle with a lot of the demons that they have carried forward with them ever since they hung up the uniform.
Right. You're exactly right. I feel you on all that. When you were growing up, I take it you read a lot of books.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, they were, I think they were probably the general grade school variety fare. You know, maybe these books that were 100 pages tops, mm-hmm. that you find at your second grade library, you know, right. that, you know, tell you a broad stroke of what happened throughout this particular historical event. And, you know, hey, here's what life was like, you know, back in the 1940s when we were fighting these bad guys who were called the Nazis, you know, all pretty much written in very basic language. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as I got older, you know, I mean, I started to read a lot more and, just started getting my hands on any historical treatise I could find.
Well, I asked that because one of the books that I remember first grabbing as far as a history account of something like you would pick up that you have written, right, is it was The Flying Tigers, and it was by John Tolan. I don't know if you've read that or not. And it's about World War II and American fighter pilots in China and Burma and all that. And what drove me to it wasn't what was on in the words. It was the cover. It was this badass plane with this mouth open. I was like, I've never seen a plane like that. That is cool, right? And I'm a kid, so obviously that's going to draw me into it. And I say that because every cover on every one of your books, whether it's a children's book or nonfiction or what have you, is so powerful. And when I opened up the package the other day and pulled this out, the Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Front Lines of World War II, holy hell, dude. Like, I know they say a picture's worth a thousand words, but coming from somebody whose family was in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, I was in Iraq, I can trace my lineage all the way back to Admiral Wood and the Scottish Navy and that shit. Like,
nice.
It touches me differently than it would a civilian that is picking it up to just for a reading moment, right? Just to pass time. And then I turned it over on back and seen that. And I was like, holy hell. Like, I don't know what goes through your mind when you're obviously designing the cover or trying to pick out what fits what. But even if you hadn't said that was World War II, automatically I'd have been like World War I too. And then turned it over on back. I was like, definitely, you know, right? So what is your thought process, for lack of a better term, when you're coming up with these covers? Because the last two, three are just mind blowing. And then, like I said, this one almost brought me to tears. I'm not going to lie.
Right. Well, thank you, brother. I sure do appreciate that. So, when I think about how I want the covers to be designed, really the first thing that goes through my mind is what is a central image that I can really have readers identify with. It has to be something that's a little bit of symbology and something that's iconic, something that will really grab the reader's attention and will resonate with them as a as an impactful image and key them in to what the book is really about. And I know that that's a very broad concept, but what I try to do is I try to go through as many different image libraries as I can to find something that, if I put it against a stock photo background, is really going to stand out. And there are a lot of different factors that'll influence the decision. You know, I mean, I'll start tweaking around with what I want to do as far as the color scheme goes, how I want the contrast and the lighting to look, what parts of the image I want to emphasize, where I might want to crop it, what color schemes or heat signatures that I might even want to add to it. If I want to make the image angled, whether I want to have it done from a forced perspective or not.
Right.
But the overall goal is to find one central image that the reader can focus on, something that is a focal point. And what also goes into that is the type of fonts that I use. You know, there's certain color schemes, and there have been like half a dozen studies out there published on like the psychology of how you make taglines and how you make movie posters and like the exact positioning of where you want something to really to grab a viewer's attention.
Right.
But, you know, I do that with the color schemes and the fonts. And I really got to hand it to my cover designer. Her name is Mel Stevens. I've used her for the last five or six book projects I've worked on. But she really is tremendous. She is a Photoshop wizard. And if there were anything close to calling Photoshop a superpower, man, she has it in spades, because she can take a lot of the rough sketches that I give her and all of the scribbled side notes to say, you know, hey, here's what I'm thinking about. You know, here's kind of how I want it to look. And, you know, she must be a mind reader, because she makes these things spot on and just really makes all of the iconography pop. And, you know, it's especially helpful for somebody like me, because I have zero artistic skills, brother. I mean, if there was a way to mess up doing stick figures, I could probably do it.
Well, I know it's cliche to say, but it's absolutely beautiful. Just, you don't even have to open it and you've already got a sense of what you're going to be stepping into. Before I go any further, Oink, I know there's a question for Mayhem. Do you want to go ahead with Mayhem's, or do you want to question Mike, or?
Well, you know, I'll get into Mayhem's question because we told him we would. Given your military historian base, what's your opinion on Ukrainians' ability to resist the Russian numbers and equipment? Is it technology, the training by the West for the last couple of decades or so, or both, do you think?
It is all of the above and more, brother. You know, when the war in Ukraine kicked off, I really was of two mindsets. I said, on the one hand, okay, if we're looking at sheer numbers and sheer brute strength, yeah, it's probably going to be a victory for Russia. But I was also telling myself, man, don't underestimate the Ukrainians. And I was actually telling this to a lot of my friends and even a lot of my fellow vets, you know, hey, when you have a small and you have a proud country like Ukraine and you back them into a corner, do not at all underestimate their resolve, because the best analogy that I can think of, and it's a crude analogy, but I think it's warranted and I think it is entirely appropriate given the situation. I kind of compare them to a dog, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful sense. I mean that in the sense of their resiliency and how they turned on their survival mechanism. Mm-hmm. Because dogs are some of the most resilient members of the animal kingdom. I mean, they will take an incredible amount of abuse, but the minute you back a dog into a corner, it will lash out at you and it will go for your throat. And that is exactly what the Ukrainians have been doing. And, you know, I got to hand it to them for a lot of the tactical ingenuity that they have displayed. And I don't really think that that is a function of any of the Western influences as much as it is, you know, how they say that necessity is the mother of all invention. Well, you know, that's what we're seeing play out. And, you know, in a broader sense, it also highlights a lot of the fatal mistakes in the Russian military and the fatal flaws that they have in how they've structured their forces. You know, one of the earliest problems that they've run into, and one that I don't think they have at all recovered from, is the lack of synchronized logistics. Because when you take a look at how the Russian army organizes their logistical apparatus, they have a very top heavy design. You know, here in the West, we call this a pull versus a push system of logistics. And it's something that I ran into a lot when I was a battalion S4, is that, you know, you have to have a synchronized and strong connection between your push logistics and your pull logistics. Well, if I am pushing something, okay, I am putting distance between myself and whatever it is I'm delivering. If I'm pulling something, I'm grabbing what is being given to me and I'm bringing it closer to where I am. Now, the Russians are very good at the push logistics, is where, you know, they have the top echelon logistical apparatuses that they have, and they're very good at pushing it over long distances. But here's the thing: a lot of their supply chains and a lot of their delivery systems are based on the old rail network, and this goes back into the old days of the Soviet defense system. Well, when those logistical apparatuses reach the end of the rail terminal line, and you have to now take all of those bullets and beans and, you know, whatever classes of supply you have on that train, and you have to project them over long land distances, well, that's where the pull part of logistics is supposed to come in. And that's not really a capability that the Russian army has developed. You know, here in the West, and particularly in the U.S. Army, you know, we have those pull logistical capabilities in the form of the forward support battalions and the sustainment brigades. So there's a steady stream of supply that is flowing from the top echelon all the way down to the end user level. Well, when you don't have a good pull side of the logistical situation, you have that breakdown in the flow of supply. The Russians start to outrun their supply lines. There's a delay in getting food and fuel and ammunition and all the other classes of supplies to the front lines. And that's why you see all these images of these Russian tanks that are running out of gas, being commandeered by Ukrainian tractors, of all things. And yeah, it is just an ungodly bloody mess. So, you know, logistics has really bitten them in the proverbial derriere. And it really just goes to show that, you know, and I swear for the life of me, I can't remember which famous general said this, but he said, weapons win battles, but logistics win wars.
Yeah. And, you know, Russia's went after other countries before that were smaller and technologically inept, if you will, and lost. Because, again, I think in their mindset, we've got this big crowd and they're angry and rawr, they're going to win. And like you said, when that country's backed into a corner, they're going to do what they have to. And then all the logistics comes into play, which obviously Russia doesn't think ahead of time. And I hate to bring them up, but I mean, you know, we've seen it in the Iraq war. I didn't know what the hell an IED was, and they were everywhere, made out of the smallest of unknown things. I mean, things you wouldn't even imagine, right? Like, that's some ingenuity right there. I mean, I'm not saying that was a good thing, but in a time of necessity, those motherfuckers got smart. Like, I mean, they really, you can do some really amazing MacGyver-esque stuff when you need to. I mean, it's unreal. Yeah. Also, Mayhem said, is it the new Iron Curtain?
Well, you know, I would not be surprised if it is. You know, I think the Iron Curtain actually started shifting its boundaries a long time ago, you know, mm-hmm. when the Cold War ended. I don't think the Iron Curtain necessarily fell. I just think it withdrew to the Polish-Russian border and started popping up again along the Chinese border. You know, I think that the Cold War itself, in more ways than one, took a pause throughout the 90s, you know, because, you know, Russia had to essentially recalibrate itself. Mm-hmm. And we had to figure out what the world was going to look like, you know, in this post-Cold War environment. And, you know, things I think were disrupted even further after 9/11, because, you know, that for us changed the nature of warfare. You know, we were still thinking in terms of conventional fighting, and then boom, now we have this whole COIN and counterinsurgency, school of thought that we have to deal with. Right. But now that, COIN is pretty much once again becoming passe, you know, we are taking a fresh look at the geopolitical landscape and telling ourselves, okay, well, China has resurged and they are now the heavy power player in Asia. And, even though communism is no longer the unifying factor between Russia and China, they are still of the mindset that, you know, hey, we have a common frenemy, if you will, in the U.S. And, how can we maintain security here on our own block and exert our own sphere of influence and be a counterbalance to the West. So, yeah, in more ways than one, I think this is the new Iron Curtain. It's just not as rigidly defined as it was back in the 80s.
Yeah, and I feel like that whole timeline that you just mentioned, for lack of a better term, was basically halftime, right? Like, let's pull our team to the side. Let's evaluate what's going on, where we can come from, what we can take and do with. That's what I feel like, you know, like essentially war is a football game, right? You have to move your players in the right position. You have to, you have to hike the ball and pass at the right time. Like, it's the same mindset, right? So that whole time from quote unquote the end of the Cold War until just recently, in a way, was halftime for Russia, just to gather basically, like you said, resources, logistics, information, technology, probably stuff we don't even know about, which I don't think everybody knows everything, but before we get too sidetracked, let's get back to the combat diaries. Sorry about that.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to point out to begin with is the dedication. It's for Mom, Dad, Marie and Melanie, and to the memory of Joan, and I'm probably going to screw this up, and please correct me, with Nasiri, 54-22. Uh-huh. Correct. Do you want to talk about that dedication at all?
Absolutely, brother. So she was the closest thing to a second mother that I ever had. She was a very close friend of the family's. We had known her for a long time. Really a staple in the community from where we lived and where we grew up. And, just an incredible woman who had a tremendously positive impact on every single life that she touched. By trade, she was a professional piano teacher. And, she actually used her music to leverage the power of ministry. She was a church pianist for, I want to say the better part of, 35 years. And I think it was even longer than that. But just an incredible woman who was a very, very close personal friend of the family's. She was a very close friend of my mother's. And the world is qualitatively a lesser place without her. And being that she had such a tremendous impact, not only on my life, but on the lives of so many other people in the community where we were from, I said, you know what? I am also going to add a dedication to Joni, because by God, she deserves it. And, even though we are all collectively lesser people without her here, I know that heaven has improved by her presence. And she's probably giving an epic concert to the angels right now.
I love it, brother. That's beautiful. I really do. I know she'd be very appreciative of you just mentioning her, but dedicating it to her, I know she would absolutely just want to hug you and kiss you and love on you. It's wonderful, brother. Before I hand it over to Oink to talk about the book, because he got to read all of it and I didn't get to read all of it. The introduction to this book, I did get to read that. And I did get to read a few of the first pages, but I've read a lot of introductions and forewords and you name it. This one is something you would hear over a movie trailer for a documentary, and it is so damn good. How did you come up with that? And where was your mindset for the introduction? Because that literally is a voiceover for a trailer. I mean, straight up, brother.
Oh, brother, I'm so glad you like it. The only thing I can really attribute it to is spot on inspiration. I wanted to, I wanted to have an opening that I that would really do justice to all of the veterans that I was talking about throughout the book. So I'm like, okay, well, how can I make a setup that really encompasses who all of these veterans were and, you know, how they fit within the broader picture of everyone who got drafted or everyone who answered the call of duty. And yeah, it was like lightning struck. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I think I'm going to open it like this. And I'm going to say, hey, these are guys who came from the wheat fields of Kansas, or they came from the streets of LA, or they came from the streets of Brooklyn, or, you know, a few Hollywood pretty boys even got the bug to serve their country, and by God, they did it, and they did it fabulously. And, you know, and no matter what walk of life they came from, you know, they all bonded together and they all said, hey, here's a job that we have to do that is for the sake of humanity. We have to defeat the forces of fascism, and we're all in this together. And that's why I think they've really earned the title of the greatest generation. And then, you know, I was like, okay, you know what? I think if I frame it like that, that'll be the best segue into exploring who each of these guys were and what all they accomplished.
I'm not going to read this entire introduction, but I want to give the listeners just a glimpse of what this is, so they know what I'm coming from. The introduction states, World War II was the most destructive conflict in human history. At its peak, the U.S. military drew some 16 million men into its ranks to defeat the Axis powers. It goes on to say, they were ordinary men who accomplished extraordinary things. Today, we call them the greatest generation. And I mean, just that alone is something you would hear on History Channel coming up for a television series. Like, I love you. I mean, I read that and I was like, oh, hell yeah, we're going to get into it. Like, that's seriously. And I even told Oink during the pre-show, I said, that is a literal trailer right there. And I just wished I could be in your head just for like a second. But I'll shut up. And since Oink got to read it from cover to cover, I'll let him scrape your mind a little bit and see what he can pull from it, if you don't mind, brother.
Well, first of all, let me start off by saying I was never a history buff in high school, and I, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. I want to kick myself in my own ass for that. But you have a way of pulling emotions out of people, especially myself, when, you know, like I said, not a history buff, but reading some of the stories. You know, I was stationed at Okinawa. And that, so much history on that island that I never took part in, that I'm now literally kicking myself in the ass for. But like I said, the stories and the way you can tell them brings out that emotion of, man, why didn't I take part in more activities like that? And the other thing is, you know, I was stationed in Germany as well. Same thing. So much history over there that I could have took more part in that I didn't. And now, hindsight 2020, I want to kick my own ass for that. But I just want to say you have a definite talent for bringing out these, you know, men and women's stories and, you know, bringing out their emotions and stuff that you could feel yourself. That's why it was so hard for me to put the book down, because once you start to get to reading their stories and listening to what these men and women, you know, went through, that, you know, it's hard to forget this was an actual event. This was something that they themselves lived and went through. And like you said, it's just that, you know, you hear history in high school, which is nowhere near the history that you're putting forth of these, you know, tremendous folks. You're the greatest generation, and you do it so well. So first off, let me just start with that. But yeah, there's so many stories in there that, like I said, it just brought back emotions and memories and stuff like that. And Omaha Red, one of the guys, you know, being the first there on the beach for D-Day as a forward observer, you know, and then the great part where he's arguing with a general at the end, he was kind of calling him out on it. I don't know if that you want to talk about that a little bit, or, you know, I just found it amusing how he kind of shut that general down. He was awesome.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that actually resonated with me quite a bit, because both in and out of the military, you know, I know we've all had to deal with people who love to play gotcha games, you know, and they love to try to take digs at you. And, you know, they try to find holes in whatever story that you're telling them, and they do it so smugly, and it really can't help but get under your skin. And I think one of the best examples of karma, and probably one of the best examples of giving somebody their just desserts, is to shut them down and say, you know, hey, mister, I was there. You weren't. Your reasoning is flawed. I know that you're trying to deconstruct it, but you're just putting on public display that you're an ignoramus. So do yourself a favor, shut it down and walk away. And this particular part of the story that you're referencing, Oink, is years later when he was at a commemorative event and he was speaking to a number of people in the audience about his experiences being the first man on Omaha Red. He was saying, okay, here is what happened from beginning to end. Here is what I saw as a forward observer. You know, I was hiding underneath all these rocks and I was calling in all this naval gunfire and artillery fire. And, to relay that story and then to have some pompous retired general come out of the woodwork and say, yeah, well, goodness, I don't believe that you were the first man on the beach because I've looked through the official records and read the official history, and that's just impossible. And the way he handled it, it was so simple, but so artful at the same time, because he said, General, what war did you fight in? Oh, I was in Korea. And Bill's like, yeah, I thought so. You look way too young to have fought in World War II. And besides, I don't remember seeing you or any other high-ranking general or official historian or reporter with a camera at 2 a.m. on the beaches of Normandy. And that was enough to take the wind out of like 50% of his sails right there. And, then to kind of see that general start tap dancing and say, oh, well, you know, I had a question about the technicality of, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, to have Bill's comeback be words to the effect of, well, you know, I saw it happen in real time and I can attest to what the ballistics of those guns can accomplish. And there are at least two dozen dead Germans who would ardently disagree with your assessment. But it's too bad that they're not alive to disagree with you in real time.
Yep. Yeah, the tactful way that he did that, I thought was just a joy to read, if you know what I'm saying, because we've all had toxic leadership in the past, you know, that we wish we could tell off. But he did it so elegantly. It was perfect. Another story that I found out was pretty interesting was Charles E. Kelly, the Medal of Honor recipient. You know, the things that he did, went through, and then the way it ended, you know, obviously it wasn't something that was very pleasant, but, it was one of those stories that you could definitely relate to, that you've heard and you've actually seen through other veterans.
Right. And that really is a modern day tragedy, you know, because here you have a kid who really grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. And there are probably a number of reasons as to why he was a juvenile delinquent. But, you know, he was really able to find redemption in the military. And despite his criminal background, he was accepted into military service. He was classified 1A for the draft and really took to the military lifestyle. And not only that, he had proven himself to the point where he had become a junior NCO. And in a battle that I can only describe as something that would come out of a movie script, you know, he pretty much single-handedly defended a piece of terrain and a piece of real estate from a German advance guard that was coming off of a nearby hill. This was in the middle of Altavilla, Italy. And, for him to keep his wits about him for that long, and when one of his rifles runs out of ammunition, he grabs another one, and then he grabs a bar, you know, he grabs a Browning automatic rifle. When that runs out of ammunition, he grabs a machine gun. When that runs out of ammunition, he goes to find something else. Then when that one no longer serves him, he picks up a bazooka, he fires off a few rounds. Then when all the rounds of that have run dry, he takes these mortar shells and he said, oh, hey, you know what? I can make this into a Johnny on the spot grenade. Takes the mortar shell, taps it on the windowsill, which activates the charge, and then starts tossing it out the window at the advancing Germans, and is able to do this over the course of several hours, and become essentially a one-man rear guard operation while he's allowing the surviving members of his unit to escape out the back door, and then join them at the rally point with barely his life intact. And when you read about what he was doing from beginning to end, you're like, wow, if there was something beyond the Medal of Honor to give that guy, he really earned it. And that was the first Medal of Honor to come out of the European theater, which, made him in more ways than one a national celebrity. But I think in a story arc that befalls a lot of returning veterans, they achieve success on the battlefield. They are able to demonstrate valor and a commitment to duty. But when they transition to civilian life, things don't always work out for them as well as they should, because he ran into a lot of hardship throughout his post-military career, had a failed business, had his first wife pass away and deplete a lot of his family finances into trying to keep her alive as she was battling cancer, and then finds redemption briefly when he marries someone else and is able to secure a job in the state of Kentucky. But for one reason or another, he just couldn't effectively wrestle with the demons that he had brought home from the war, and ends up living an itinerant existence after abandoning his family, and then ultimately facilitates his own death. Yeah, so it's an equal parts triumph and tragedy. And the subtext that I want a lot of the readers to take away from that is that, even though we think of World War II as a good war, and we're certainly proud that we won, and we're proud that we defeated the forces of Nazism, the mental health and the long-term well-being of our returning veterans in that conflict was little more than an afterthought.
Yep.
And it's something that we need to pay a lot more attention to now with our own returning veterans, and thank God that there's more of a foundation in place to help returning veterans and help transition, the transitioning veterans, whether it's at the VA, whether it's at Wounded Warrior, whether it's the DAV, or if you're still on active duty, it could even be the Warrior Transition Units. But there is a much more forceful effort to make sure that our veterans are well adjusted, and that they can readjust after a life in the military.
If you don't mind, really quick to add on to what Mike's saying, I think a lot of where people's mindset too at the time was, let's do this parades and fanfare and congratulate the returning soldiers and everything will be fine. And that's great. That's wonderful to come home to, that first few days. It's great to be on the up and up and happy and celebrating. But I think a lot of them, especially that time, because I think most of us had grandparents from that time, were so hard. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but nobody showed emotion. And I think most of our generations took away some of that, and we still hold it. I know I do. I'm a hard ass. I hate crying.
No, I perfectly agree with you. I mean, when you're born and raised basically during the, the Great Depression, where, mm-hmm. You were fighting for food scraps, just to get a meal, and then to have this war come up, after just going through a World War I, so now you're doing it again, but now it's against somebody that's just totally evil, like, Hitler was. And, the surprise by the Japanese, kind of threw us on that front as well. And just some of the torture that they talked about that some of these guys and women went through, just the brutality of war itself. It's something that wasn't captured on camera a lot back in the day, or talked about, in medias and, mm-hmm. and what have you. So just the brutality of war back then was, recognizable today, I think.
Well, also, I've brought this up before, and I think I brought it up a couple of weeks ago, and War Dog was with us too. Some of the best comedians have went through the worst of pains, and who came out of World War One and Two? You've got Don Rickles and Jimmy Stewart and Walter Matthau, and I can go on with actors who were in these wars. James Stewart flew a fucking plane, and Walter Matthau was his gunner. I mean, and then you look at Don Rickles' humor, and then you look at somebody else who didn't go through war or go through civil rights or anything like that. And they're good. I'll give them credit, but it's not as reality based, right? It's not as painful when you get down to the nitty gritty of what you're laughing at. And I've not dove deep into all of these people's, i.e. celebrities' lives. But when you get to see interviews or read stories where they were talking about their time in war, it was so miserable and they never forgot about it. And again, I think our grandparents and ancestors at that time were in the mindset of, okay, we've done we gave you praise. You should be happy now. And the fact that everybody was quote unquote hard, it was a suck it up and move on moment. And nobody like today, shed light on PTSD or depression or the realities of after war, right? Like you can leave the battlefield, but the wars never leave your mind ever. Like none of that never leaves. The pain is still there. Whether you got shot or watched your best friend die, it's there. And I hate to, you know, be the Debbie Downer, but it's true. And I think you, Mike, doing this book and the other books and any book that actually shows, hey, I'm not the only one. Cause like you were talking about, that story is the reality of many of our brothers and sisters who've unfortunately joined the 22. Like, you know, that's because you, if you talk to them, that's all they would think about is why wasn't it me, and et cetera, et cetera. So again, thank you for that, Mike.
Absolutely, brother. It's my pleasure.
Sorry.
Something else that I kind of picked up on though too, is that, you know, this is just 16 stories of folks that were located, I'm assuming that your area of the woods in Minnesota area, you know, so how many more stories are out there that haven't been told? That should be told, it should be recognized, you know, and this is just 16 stories that are amazing. First of all, like I said, you have a way of bringing those stories out and to life, you know, that makes the reader actually feel, you know, some of the emotions that they went through. But I mean, like I said, Commando Kelly, any guy that can fire enough rounds that the barrel gets hot enough that it sets a bed on fire, you know, he's a badass. So like I said, I just think you have a great way of putting these stories together and out there. And like I said, continue to do it because these stories need to be told.
Absolutely, brother. And, you know, I mean, I can tell the listening audience out there tonight that that this installment of the Combat Diaries is actually the first in an anthology, because there's going to be there's at least going to be a volume 2 and a volume 3 of the Combat Diaries that are going to be compiling even more stories like this. Because, Oink, it's just like you said, brother. There are so many stories out there that I think need to have a broader audience and really need to be told. And, you know, for as long as I have the means and for as long as I am drawing oxygen and have the mental wherewithal to do it, brother, I'm going to keep on telling these stories.
And, you know,
why do I appreciate it?
Exactly. And I mentioned, you know, my family that's been in all these numerous wars, whether it was in America or elsewhere. I don't regret anything in life, but I do regret that when I was younger, I didn't know that my uncle was in Vietnam. I didn't know that until after he died, and I've got his freaking combat boots literally in my closet. And then my grandpa, I knew he was in the army. That's all I ever knew. I didn't know what war or anything. And then I found out he was in World War II, and I've got his butt pack and it says wood on it. Like he literally wrote with a marker wood. And it's like, if I could go back, I would so pick their brains if they were willing to talk. Like the stories that comes from them. And even if they'd wrote it down, you know what I mean? Like, and that's one thing I wanted to know. Like, did you compile this and write it from families, from archives, from interviews?
It was a little bit of all three, brother. You know, I mean, of the of all of the gentlemen who appear in that book, only three of them are still living today. And they're all in their late 90s. But this was a combination of both individuals whom I interviewed, they were materials that were provided by family, or they were, they were things that I had come across in archival research, and even other historians, even local members of the American Legion who have previously interviewed veterans and, you know, maintained those interview stories and allowed me to publish them in the book. So, I search high and low to find a good, to find a good mix of stories that I can put together in a narrative that I think flows and will keep the reader interested. But regardless of their source, I'm just incredibly grateful that I had the chance to come across these stories, had the chance to interview some of these gentlemen and preserve their stories so that their legacies don't die off with them.
I love it. I didn't mean to cut in with you, Oink. I'm sorry. No,
you're fine.
It was one of those questions that I had and it slipped away, and I was like, oh, that question.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, like I said, I just found it hard to put down once you started reading their stories and getting to know things that they went through and saw, you know, cause like you said, the history that we're taught in school is nowhere close to what these men and women faced, you know, during that time. So to have it like a firsthand accountability of these actions and stuff is amazing to read through. I mean, some of it obviously is not so happy in the ending, but it's a lot of stories I think that a lot of veterans can relate to, obviously. Not being in a combat situation myself, I think War Dog, if he reads the book, can relate a lot to what these men went through, you know. So again, hats off, just the way that you put this stuff together and can tell the stories.
Well, thank you, brother. I appreciate that. And, you know, it's an interesting aside. After completing this project and compiling all the stories together, you really find out in a roundabout way just how small of a world it is out there, because completely unbeknownst to me, while I was writing the combat diaries, there was one gentleman whose story I told, the story of Bob Johnson, who was the Marine artillery officer on Guadalcanal. Incredible story behind that guy, and and not only his wartime service, but the longevity of his legal career afterwards, because here you had a guy who briefly served as a judge. He was a district attorney for 30 years, and instead of retiring for good, became a private practice attorney for, I think, an additional 35 years. And he was actively litigating cases all the way up until his 80s. I mean, I don't think he retired for good until he was 89. the funny anecdote that I can put behind that is, and again, this was completely unbeknownst to me while I was putting the story together, but I come to find out right as the book is going to pre-press that my neighbor's mother was once upon a time Bob Johnson's legal secretary.
Whoa.
Huh. I'm just thinking, oh, wow. I mean, when I found that out, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I was just like, oh man, small world. I had no idea. That's but awesome. Yeah, I mean, I was chatting with my neighbor, and I was mentioning the names of some of the gentlemen that I was going to be putting in the book, and I mentioned that there was a fabulous local Minnesotan, no less, who was a Marine artillery officer on Guadalcanal. And it's like, yeah, he was a lawyer after the war, and wouldn't you believe this guy was, you know, was litigating cases, you know, all the way up until his late 80s. And, you know, gosh, he was, you know, he was being a real life Perry Mason while, you know, most of his friends are doing the shuffleboard. And she asked me what his name was. And I said, Bob Johnson. And she's like, oh, my God, my mom used to work for him. And yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's yeah. So it really is a small world. And I think further, the subtext would be that, you know, so many of these veterans, they continue to touch lives, and they continue to be a force for good and a positive influence in their community. And, you know, the lasting legacy that they leave behind, when you can still recall somebody who your mother worked for years ago. And, you know, here we are going on 12 years that Bob Johnson's been passed on now. You know, that really right there is the biggest indication that you've made a positive impact in somebody's life, when, you know, years afterwards, they're still remembering you and they can still speak of you fondly and remember you fondly.
I love that. That's just Jesus. That's that's one of those slap in the face reality moments. You're like, wait, what? Oh, my God. Yeah. It's, you know, I flip through every book I get just to get a sense of what it's going to, you know, entail and things of that nature. And one thing I love about this book is you do have some pictures, portraits and things of that nature. And it kills me. It absolutely kills me that I do not have any portraits of my grandpa in his Marine, you know, dress, or my great grandpa in his Army greens, or anything. And I just love that you're able to put a face to these stories, for the most part. Because I think when people read something like this and they don't see somebody, it's just another story. It's a real story, but I don't think it's as impactful, in my opinion, personally. I might be wrong. I don't know. But I think it's like, you know, reading a story versus watching the movie, right? Like, you get more of a sense of the visualizations, even though it's good to read the book. It's good to read the story. I get that. But like I said, putting a face with the name, with yelling at the general, et cetera. I applaud you for that as well. I have nothing bad to say about Mike, you guys. I can't. I've tried. I can't, damn it. No, I'm joking. Wardog,
I know you've been, brother.
Wardog, I know you've been sitting there listening to us talk about the Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Frontlines of World War II by Mr. Mike Gordia. Is there anything you want to talk to him about with this book or his writings or anything?
Oh, obviously, I'm in awe of Mike each time he's here. So that's why I'm, you know, in silence, just taking everything in. Because, you know, how rarely do you ever run into someone so well-written, well-spoken, and informed, man, as Mike is. So my hat's off to him for every single book project that he's been able to complete and bring to fruition. The things that you write and you mentioned within this book here, I mean, Bo mentioned it earlier with the cover alone is what hooked me. The cover and the way you were mentioning, you know, the color tones and everything that you use and want to apply towards gathering attention. You got me hooked, and you've had me hooked now for well over a year. So well over two years now. So my actual question Mayhem took. I was going to ask your take on Ukraine as well and how well they're handling things, but you answered that, you know, beautifully. You answered his question about them possibly being the second Iron Curtain. And that's basically where I was coming from. So you you put a check in every box as you always do each time you're on air with us for me, man.
Thank you, brother. I really can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And, you get in praise like that from my fellow veterans. That is what makes a lot of my endeavors worthwhile. You know, if it can, if I can tell these stories and have them resonate with, the folks who have worn the same uniform and served under the same flag, I will consider all of these endeavors successful. And it's always a pleasure to be on the show and be able to share this with you guys, because in a real matter of speaking, I mean, we all belong to that 1%, and sometimes it seems that the population of that 1% is shrinking every day.
Yeah, it definitely is. We've got about 35 more minutes for the show, and I don't know how much longer you've got, Mike, but I want to tell everybody, we talk about Betsy Ross and the fight series and how easy it is to read her book and how short it is. And Mike is right there alongside her. His books are so easy to read. Anybody could read them, literally. This one's only 168 pages, but in the first couple of pages, you get so much information and you get so much detail and visuals, smells. Obviously, if you're somebody that needs to take a break while you're reading something like this, obviously do it. But if you're someone that is a history buff, that I am or any of us are, do pick it up. You won't regret it at all. It's not only money well spent, it's time well spent. And hopefully I'll get to sit down and go through every single damn book of Betsy and Mike's very soon, but I have so much on my plate. It's not even funny. I've been busy all week. And that's not a cop out. That's the truth. I tried to sit down and read it today and I ended up talking to Recoil for 2 hours on the phone today. So, is there anything, Mike, in an interview, whether it's the Combat Diaries or any book you've done, a question that's never answered that you wish would get answered so you could answer it?
Gosh, let's see. I don't know if there's a particular question that's never been answered, but.
Or asked. I'm sorry. I said answered. Okay. I thought I said that wrong, but I was like, did I or did I think that? I'm an idiot. Is there a question that's never been asked that you would like to be asked so you could answer it?
You're good, brother. So let's see. Well, a question that I have thought about asking on a number of occasions, but I never did, was, were you scared? And the reason I've never asked that is because I probably already know the answer. Right. Of course, anybody in that situation is going to be scared. And I think you would have to be more than a little touched not to be. Mm-hmm. But I know that if that question were to be asked, there would probably be one or two out there who would deny it for whatever reason. And I don't know why. That's just my speculation. Mm-hmm. But, and now that I think about it in a little more depth, I think maybe a question that I should have asked was, well, and I won't even say that I should have asked it, just one that I think may have been a poignant conversation starter would be, how was the adjustment process for you after you came home? Oh. And, again, that's probably a question that I want to ask, but I know I never will unless they bring it up first. Mm-hmm. Because, the process of readjusting, it's different for everyone. Everyone processes trauma differently. Everyone bears the scars differently.
Yep.
And it's a healing really is a continuous process. And everyone develops their own coping mechanisms along the way. And that's probably something that needs to be explored in more depth. but it's probably something I would never ask unless one of my vet subjects brought it up first. And that really, for me, I guess would be more of a courtesy than anything else, because I wouldn't want to reopen any wounds or, you know, rub salt on anything that's still kind of raw.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I feel like it's almost like asking, did you shoot anybody? Did you kill anybody?
Yeah.
You don't do that. Like, it's a respect thing. I don't get mad at kids because kids are kids, right?
Right.
But I've had so many adults, well, did you ever shoot your gun? And you're like, yeah, I shot my gun. Well, no, when you were in Iraq. It's like, are you seriously asking me whether I did or not? That's not the point. Like, I don't want to talk about any of that, whether I did or not. Like, you don't ask somebody that. I don't care how young or old they are. Nobody, when you get down to it, nobody wants to talk about it unless, like you said, they bring it up. And I wholeheartedly agree with everything you said there. But that would be something again, like you said, I think probably should be explored to an extent.
Can I speak on that just a little bit?
Definitely.
I kind of find that it you come into respecting the game and respecting that whatever you did, they could have done as well. So, you know, when there's not all that rah, 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 you know, going on around things, mm-hmm. and you own up to the fact that the situation could have gone either way. Mm-hmm. There's just not a lot that is left to really need to speak about. I think that's why a lot of people may not, besides the, you know, emotional issues behind it. But a lot of the infantry Marines that I've fought with, we can joke and this and that, but mm-hmm. during the time, whether it was rushing into Baghdad or rushing into Fallujah after the Blackwater guys were murdered, we just respected the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. I'm right there with you. I think that's how it should be. Yeah. I like that. Respect the game. I didn't think of it like that.
Because it's, you know, it's easy now after everything to be, you know, to speak with such, you know, machismo and all. And, but, you know, you got to respect that when you were in country, you didn't know what the hell was going to happen. You didn't know, or whatever did happen towards you that you did towards the enemy could have also happened. So, you walk on eggshells around that part while you're under the fire and still in country, I feel. And you get the bragging and the lies once you come home.
Yeah. If you seen some of the people I knew, it was bragging before they got in the service. you did mention, Mike, that this is going to be at least a volume 2 and 3. Is there any other projects you want to tell the listeners about that you have upcoming or that you're hoping to get started or anything like that?
Absolutely, brother. As a matter of fact, got quite a few irons in the fire right now. Just to give a preview as to what's out there. And it's ironic because I had intended this project to come out sooner, but the war in Ukraine made me put this project on hold, at least for the time being. It was a combat history of the MiG-29.
Oh, wow.
And I had a bunch of resources compiled and had some good data that I was going to put into it. And then when the Ukraine war kicked off, I was telling myself, no, there's going to be a whole new chapter, probably multiple chapters of MiG-29 combat operations coming out of this. Not the least of which was my fascination with the Ghost of Kiev, who recently was confirmed to be a myth. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, what a what a fabulous story. I mean,
right.
I was hoping that that guy was real, because I was like, whoever this fella is, I want to get his story down on paper. Right. What I think I'm going to do with it now is, I'm going to continue to, I'm of course going to continue working on that project and, you know, add Ukrainian MiG operations to a certain point. And then say in the epilogue of the book that, you know, given the ongoing situation in Ukraine, there will be an updated and revised edition of this book coming soon. Please stay tuned. But another project that I have in the works as of right now, I'll give you a preview on a few of them. One is about the spy war in Bosnia. And, when we had our peacekeeping mission over there, the U.S. Army had its own cadre of counterintelligence agents who were working all these human operations against the Serbs and the Croats, and all of the intrigue and spy versus spy stories that entails. So that's one project that I have in the hopper. And another one that I'm working on as well is a story, fascinating one, and one that I'm surprised has not had more coverage over the years. It's about the Cuban revolt in Panama. If you take those words I just said together, it might make someone out there give pause and say, a Cuban revolt happening in Panama, what the heck is that about? So to give the setup, this is the mid-90s, and this is when we still had the Panama Canal Zone. Well, we were having an uptick in the number of Cuban refugees who were, you know, trying to escape the Castro regime, and they were being picked up around the southern edges of Miami and the Florida Keys and whatnot. There was a point in the mid-90s where we were taking a lot of these Cuban refugees and we were holding them at Guantanamo Bay as a holding area until we could get them processed through INS and we could actually grant them asylum status. Well, the facilities at Gitmo were overflowing at one point, to where they said, okay, well, the next batch of refugees that we get, we're going to have to send to the Panama Canal Zone, and we're going to have to hold them there for a while. And this was 94, 95, that they had the Cubans who were in these holding cells in the Canal Zone. And for one reason or another, and of course, there are many reasons behind it, the Cuban refugees in the Panamanian holding area, they started a riot. And this was no small riot. I mean, this turned into a huge brawl that lasted the better part of 48 hours. And they had to call in the Rangers and the Marine forces that were stationed in the Canal Zone at the time to put down this riot. And when you look at it from start to finish, this is actually the tagline that I'm using to market the book, is that it was the forgotten Mogadishu of the West.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Damn.
Right. Jeez.
That's a way to put it.
Yeah. I mean, just an incredible story. You know, I mean, you know, you had a, you know, you had armed Rangers and Marines who were fighting these Cuban refugees. And there's one fella who I'm in the process of interviewing. He's a former Air Force medic. He was with, what the heck was the Air Force base down there? I want to say Clark Field, but I don't think that's right. He was an Air Force medic who was in the Canal Zone. And, he was treating a lot of the Cuban refugees that were injured. And some of them, unfortunately, he couldn't save, because in their panic, some of these refugees actually jumped into the Panama Canal itself and they ended up drowning.
Whoa.
But an incredible story where truth is stranger than fiction and doesn't really get a lot of the press coverage that I think it deserves. So yeah, that's why I'm diving into that one.
I've got to tell you, the one that really perked my ears was the Bosnia one that you mentioned. And the reason for that, believe it or not, if you ever do anything on the Soviet Communist Party, let me know. Because I have two original USSR Soviet Communist Party membership books with their IDs, like full on.
No kidding.
Yes.
The hell did you get those?
I'm very good. I think it's two. I think it's two that I have. I might have a couple more. And they're all different people. And then I have original silk maps, escape and evasion maps from World War II.
Nice.
So
I give to get my hands on those.
Oh, dude. Trust me.
Barter.
I don't think so. Not anytime soon. I have a lot of old stuff. I think I even have a pack of unused cigarettes from the British Navy, if I'm not mistaken, is what it's from. I have a lot of old shit, dude, like antique shit.
A National Museum, we need to know about. I mean, damn.
I even have, you guys have seen Enemy at the Gates, right?
Yeah.
I have the actual rifles. I have both of them. I have two of each. And they were actually war used. I'm telling you, man, I love my history. Whenever
damn
I get
mafia connections there, boy.
whenever I get my house built, I'll have a whole museum room and it'll all be basically Vietnam era and back. I mean, I have so much stuff. It's ridiculous. Like, I look at it and I'm like, if I had that money today. But then you look at it and it's priceless. It really is. I almost, this is how much I love history. I almost bought an original Nazi SS badge that was lost and found, and it was worn on a uniform, and I almost bought it. But then I was like, if I buy this, I'm going to have every government agency knocking down my door because I have a piece of Nazi gear in my house. So I passed it up, unfortunately. Next time I'm getting the ring. I've seen a couple SS rings, and it's not that I am a Nazi. Let's get that straight. Let's get that out of the way. I love how much history it has behind it and the stories that it can tell. And those silk maps, those are, oh my God, you'll never find them again. That's for sure. So, but if you ever need some references or photocopies, like, let me know. I'll definitely try to find those Communist Party membership books, because I opened them up. And you know, you ever open up an old book and you get that smell from it from like the 60s or 70s?
Oh, yeah.
That's, you could smell the time of those books when you open them up. And I was like, oh my God, this person actually used this back in whatever year it was. And I was like the stories it could tell, you know, like, oh my God, this is mine now. Anyway. Sorry, I had a nostalgia moment.
That's great, man. I'm glad to hear that you got all this cool stuff.
I wish I could display it, but I basically live in a studio apartment right now. So. Maybe one of these days when I get that $1 million sponsorship for DV Radio, I can I can get it fixed. Wardog, Oink, is there anything you want to ask Mike or anything before we let him go? Because I know he's probably like, God, I need to go.
No, I just want to, like I said, reiterate to keep doing what he's doing, because the way he brings these stories to fruition out to for everybody else to you know, partake in, to see a history in a different side, you know, than what we were taught, is amazing. And you do it so elegantly. And like I said, something that once you get started reading these books, you just can't put down. So keep doing what you're doing. I like the way you're doing it, and I have no complaints whatsoever.
I want to thank you. I want to thank you. And I want to thank you again for being the voice, because it matters to me, for being the voice and telling the stories. So many, you know, amazing stories go unheard of. So the fact that you're able to find these individuals, lay down actual facts, give amazing context around everything, I just want to thank you, bro. And when I'm 75, if you ever like to hook up for a book, let me know, man. I'll be, you know, an aging veteran by then too, and you know.
Well, I won't have to wait that long, brother.
I tell you, like, I know I praise you and everything every time you come on, but there is nothing but praise for you, Mike, and everything you do to carry these stories on and cement it proverbially in history. For some kid in 30 or 40 years to read at their library or to research for something else that they're going to tell a story about or whatever, it's like War Dog said, thank you. I mean, there's no other word. I appreciate every bit of sweat and tears and ink and tapping and probably blood, I'm sure, at some point you put into every story.
Well, certainly my blood pressure.
Well, I mean, yeah, if it wasn't high before DB radio, it certainly is now.
You're saying that standard issue for all military blood pressure be high.
and like Wink said, the emotions that you can pull from somebody with just a few simple words, put in the right combination, it's there's no word to describe how, in my opinion, important what you're doing is. So thank you for that, on behalf of us here at DV Radio and anybody that might be listening.
Well, thank you, brothers. I mean, I really can't tell you how much that means to me. And, I want to thank you guys for letting me bend your ear, for letting me on the program. And, I also want to thank you all as well, for everything that you do and, everything that you do to keep the DV community alive. Cause all of our brothers and sisters out there, they need that voice and they need that point of light. And it's an incredible honor for me to be able to share these stories with you guys and, you know, to get some of your precious airtime. So all that thanks, believe me, it is reciprocated. And as far as I'm concerned, you all are family.
Hey, brother, you were a family.
Same here.
The first episode you were on, I was like, this dude's a family man. Welcome to the family. seriously, you are part of the family. Hopefully one day we can reach a few million people and blow you and Betsy and everybody out of the water and I get you the recognition you all rightfully deserve. Seriously. I mean, for those that are listening, whether it's live or on podcast, please, please, please at least check out the Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Front Lines of World War II by Mike Guardia, whether it's on Smile to Amazon or his website where you can see all of what he's got going on, MikeGuardia.com. If you haven't seen his children's books, please go read those. Those are wonderful. I've actually sent some to my teacher friends who read them in their classes, and they love them. Their kids love them. So you're doing something right.
Glad.
If that's all, thank you, Mike. And I can't wait for your next series of anything. Like, seriously, I told Oink, I was like, wonder what he's working on just a couple months ago. And then you hit us up with this and I was like, oh, well, that wasn't that long. That was quick. It was like you heard us.
It was literally, I think, days mm-hmm. after we were talking about it.
Yep.
Oh, well, thank you, brothers. And yeah, you all have a standing invite for priority access to any of my new titles that come out.
Thank you, brother. Right, as always, you've got an open-ended invite. Just be like, yo, I need this date. Let me on. I hope you have a wonderful weekend and hope your family's doing well, brother.
All right, brother, and right back at you.
All right.
I got to tell you guys, always fun. Thanks for the time. Please stay safe, and God bless every one of you.
You as well, brother. Right, thank you.
See you, Mike. Great show. Cheers.
I'm going to tell you what, guys. Every time he comes on, I don't want to stop talking to him.
No, like I said, the way he can bring out these stories is fucking amazing. And like you said, just a combination of words that he uses to put on that paper that can bring emotions out of you that you don't realize, you know, that, like I said, hindsight's always 20/20 with me, because when I read his books, you know, there's so much history that I was sort of around or could have been a part of or took more, you know, participation in, like Okinawa or Germany, some of the history stuff there. It makes me want to kick my own ass, to be honest with you, you know, because you were there. How many people actually have a chance to go to Germany and see some of the things that I seen, you know what I'm saying? Or could have seen. Yeah. Same thing with Okinawa. How many people have actually gone to Okinawa that could actually partake in that history if they just took the time? And that's all I had was time. You know, I'm on an island. Where the fuck am I going to go? So,
well, I write fiction and I've let you read a few of my things. And yep. If I wrote something real, I don't know I could do it. Like here on page 55, I'm just going to read you this one passage. As I was flipping through, it caught me. But this is what it says. This is how good fucking Mike Gordia is. It says, still, the Spitfire held up remarkably well in a dogfight. One of its few drawbacks, however, was its line of sight. When it was on the ground, it was impossible to see straight ahead because of the angle of the plane, as Rod remembered. For that reason, you always saw Spitfire pilots zigzagging down the runway so they could look out the side windows and see what was in front of them. Like that alone, you can literally see that. And I've seen that a thousand. Yeah, I've seen that a thousand times. Now I know why the hell they look like fucking ants going down the damn runway.
Yeah, you don't have that problem in the common F-15 or 22 of today. You know what I'm saying? So,
but I mean, that little bit alone, it's like, okay.
Yep.
What else did you put in here? Like, and I mean, every time, just the covers alone, man. I've seen a lot of book covers in my life, trust me. And his and Betsy's always draws me to them, because whether they're colorful or not, it's just like, that's something, you know? It's like, I know we're visual beings. Humans go off of visual cues. But when you can pick up a book or a movie just based off the cover and you're happy, you're ecstatic with it, that says a lot. Because it wasn't the fact that it says Combat Diaries in yellow and the rest is in white font. It was the fact that you've got a soldier with an M1, I believe, in his hands going across the battlefield. And then on back, you've got two on top of a dilapidated, actually it's a blasted out roof. Like, you know you're going to get into the shit in here. And I know every veteran listening to me right now knows what I mean by getting into the shit. There's going to be some stories in here that you're going to be like, oh, damn. Right on. So, and I know everybody's like, oh my God, stop sucking his dick. Look, if you have read one of Mike Gordia's books, you know where I'm coming from. It's not dick sucking at all. It's praise. It's straight up praise. And, yeah, I think he needs to he and Betsy needs a lot more recognition for their writings. They're so amazing. Anyway, The Combat Diaries, true stories from the front lines of World War II. Mike Gordia, go check it out. Read it. Do it now.
Do it.
Stop what you're doing. Go over to smile.amazon.com, make DV Farm your charity of choice, and then type in The Combat Diaries. Right? Oh, okay, you got it. True stories. There you go. From the front lines. Uh-huh. There you go. Of World War II. Uh-huh. And Mike Gordia. There you go. Now buy it. I don't care if it's Kindle. That's okay. Read it on your little tablet or whatever. Just get the damn book and read it. How do you like that for a promotion?
It was original.
I even gave them time to type it out. Because you know they're all using autocorrect. Type one letter and all that shit comes up.
DV Radio.